she was always weeping, like a frightened little girl. The cats never weep, she told herself. No more than wolves do. It's just a stupid dream. The long canal took Brusco's boat beneath the green copper domes of the Palace of Truth and the tall square towers of the Prestanes and Antarians, before passing under the immense grey arches of the Sweetwater River to the district known as Silty Town, where the buildings were smaller and less grand. Later in the day, the canal would be choked with serpent boats and barges, but in the pre-dawn darkness they had the waterway almost to themselves. Brusco liked to reach the fish market just as the Titan roared to herald the coming of the sun. The sound would boom across the lagoon, faint with distance, but still loud enough to wake the sleeping city. By the time Brusco and his sons tied up by the fish market, it was swarming with heron sellers and codwives, oystermen, clam diggers, stewards, cooks, small wives, and sailors off the galleys, all haggling loudly with one another as they inspected the morning catch. Brusco would walk from boat to boat, having a look at all the shellfish, and from time to time tapping a cask or crate with his cane. "This one," he would say. "Yes, tap, tap. This one, tap, tap. No, not that. Here, tap." He was not much one for talking. Talia said her father was as grudging with his words as with his coins. Oysters, clams, crabs, mussels, cockles, sometimes prawns. Brusco bought it all, depending on what looked best each day. It was for them to carry the crates and casks that he tapped back to the boat. Brusco had a bad back and could not lift anything heavier than a tankard of brown ale. Cat always stank of brine and fish by the time they pushed off for home again. She had grown so used to it that she hardly even smelled it any more. She did not mind the work. When her muscles ached from lifting or her back got sore from the weight of a cask, she told herself that she was getting stronger. Once all the casks were loaded, Brusco shoved them off again, and his sons pulled them back up the long canal. Bray and Talia sat at the front of the boat, whispering to one another. Cat knew that they were talking about Bray's boy, the one she climbed up on the roof to meet after her father was asleep.
"Learn three new things before you come back to us," the kindly man had commanded Cat when he sent her forth into the city.
She always did. Sometimes it was no more than three new words of the Bravasi tongue. Sometimes she brought back sailors' tales of strange and wondrous happenings from the wide, wet world beyond the Isles of Bravos. Wars and rains of toads and dragons hatching. Sometimes she learned three new japes or three new riddles, or tricks of this trade or the other, and every so often she would learn some secret. Bravos was a city made for secrets, a city of fogs and masks and whispers. Its very existence had been a secret for a century, the girl had learned. Its location had been hidden thrice that long.
"The nine free cities are the daughters of Valeria that was," the kindly man taught her. "But Bravos is the bastard child who ran away from home. We are a mongrel folk, the sons of slaves and whores and thieves. Our forebears came from half a hundred lands to this place of refuge, to escape the dragon lords who had enslaved them. Half a hundred guards came with them, but there is one god, all of whom shared in common.
Him have many faces."
"And many names," the kindly man had said. "In Kohor he is the black goat, in Yaitai the lion of night, in Westeros the stranger. All men must bow to him in the end, no matter if they worship the Seven or the Lord of Light, the Moon Mother or the Drowned God or the Great Shepherd. All mankind belongs to him. Else somewhere in the world would be a folk who live forever. Do you know of any folk who live forever?"
"No," she would answer. "All men must die."
Cat would always find the kindly man waiting for her when she went creeping back to the temple on the knoll. On the night the moon went black.
"Oh, what do you know that you did not know when you left us?"
he would always ask her.
"I know what blind Beko puts in the hot sauce he uses on his oysters,"
she would say.
"I know the mummers at the Black Lantern are going to do the Lord of the Woeful Countenance, and all the mummers at the ship mean to answer with Seven Drunken Oarsmen. I know the bookseller Lothol Lanel sleeps in the house of the tradesman captain Marido Prestain. Whenever the honorable tradesman captain is away on a voyage, and moves out whenever the vixen comes home."
"It's good to know these things."
"And who are you?" "No one."
"You lie. You are Cat of the Canals. I know you well.
Go and sleep, child. On the morrow you must serve." "All men must serve."
And so she did. 3 days of every 30. When the moon was black, she was no one. A servant of the many-faced god in a robe of black and white. She walked beside the kindly man through the fragrant darkness, carrying her iron lantern. She washed the dead, went through their clothes, and counted out their coins. Some days she still helped Uma the cook, chopping big white mushrooms and boning fish. But only when the moon was black. The rest of the time she was an orphan girl, in a pair of battered boots, too big for her feet, and a brown cloak with a ragged hem, crying,
"Mussels and cockles and clams!"
as she wheeled her barrow through the ragman's harbour. The moon would be black tonight, she knew. Last night it had been no more than a sliver.
"What do you know that you did not know when you left us?"
the kindly man would ask as soon as he saw her.
"I know that Briscoe's daughter, Bray, meets a boy on the roof when her father's asleep,"
she thought.
"Bray lets him touch her, Talia says, even though he's just a roof rat, and all the roof rats are supposed to be thieves."
That was only one thing, though. Cat would need two more. She was not concerned. There were always new things to learn down by the ships. When they returned to the house, Cat helped Briscoe's sons unload the boat. Briscoe and his daughters divided the shellfish amongst three barrows, arranging them on layered beds of seaweed.
"Come back when all is sold,"
Briscoe told the girls, just as he did every morning, and they set forth to cry the catch. Bray would wheel her barrow to the Purple Harbour to sail to the Bravassi sailors, whose ships were anchored there. Talia would try the alleys around the moon pool, or sail amongst the temples on the Isle of the Gods. Cat headed for the Ragman's Harbour, as she did 9 days of every 10. Only Bravassi were permitted use of the Purple Harbour, from the Drowned Town and the Sea Lord's Palace. Ships from her sister cities and the rest of the wide world had to use the Ragman's Harbour, a poorer, rougher, dirtier port than the Purple. It was noisier as well, as sailors and traders from half a hundred lands crowded its wharfs and alleys, mingling with those who served and preyed upon them. Cat liked it best of any place in Braavos. She liked the noise and the strange smells, and seeing what ships had come in on the evening tide, and what ships had departed. She liked the sailors, too. The boisterous Tairushi with their booming voices and dyed whiskers, the fair-haired Lyseni, always trying to niggle down her prices, the squat, hairy sailors from the port of Ibn, growling curses in low, raspy voices. Her favourites were the summer islanders with their skins as smooth and dark as teak. They wore feathered cloaks of red and green and yellow, and the tall masts and white sails of their swan ships were magnificent. And sometimes there were West Tarossi, too, oarsmen and sailors off Carrick's out of Old Town, trading galleys out of Duskendale, King's Landing and Gulltown, big-bellied wine-cogs from the Arbour. Cat knew the Bravassi words for mussels and cockles and clams, but along the Ragman's Harbour she cried her wares in the trade tongue, the language of the wharfs and docks and sailors' taverns, a coarse jumble of words and phrases from a dozen languages, accompanied by hand signs and gestures, most of them insulting. Those were the ones that Cat liked best. Any man who bothered her was apt to see the fig, or hear himself described as an ass's pistol, or a camel's cunt.
"Well, maybe I never saw a camel," she would tell them, "but I know a camel's cunt when I smell one."
Once in a great while she would make someone angry, but when it did, she had her finger knife. She kept it very sharp, and knew how to use it, too. Red Ruggo showed her one afternoon at the Happy Port, while he was waiting for Lana to come free. He taught her how to hide it up her sleeve and slip it out when she had need of it, and how to slice a purse so smooth and quick the coins would all be spent before their owner even missed them. That was good to know, even the kindly man agreed, especially at night when the bravos and roof rats were abroad. Cat had made friends along the wharfs, porters and mummers, rope makers and sailmenders, taverners, brewers and bakers, and beggars and whores. They bought clams and cockles from her, told her true tales of bravos, and lies about their lives, and laughed at the way she talked when she tried to speak bravosi. She never let that trouble her. Instead, she showed them all a fig, and told them they were camel cunts, which made them roar with laughter. Jaloro Dathari taught her filthy songs, and his brother Jeleno told her the best places to catch eels. The mummers of the ship showed her how a hero stands, and taught her speeches from the Song of the Roin, the Conqueror's Two Wives, and the Merchant's Lusty Lady. Quill, the sad-eyed little man who made up all the bawdy farces for the ship, offered to teach her how a woman kisses, but Taganaro smacked him with a codfish and put an end to that. Kosomo, the conjurer, instructed her in sleight of hand. He could swallow mice and pull them from her ears. "It's magic," he'd say. "It's not," Cat said. "The mouse was up your sleeve the whole time. I could see it moving." "Oysters, clams, and cockles," were Cat's magic words, and like all good magic words, they could take her almost anywhere. She had boarded ships from Lice and Old Town and the port of Ibn, and sold her oysters right on deck. Some days she rolled her barrow past the Towers of the Mighty to offer baked clams to the guardsmen at their gates. Once she cried her catch on the steps of the Palace of Truth, and when another peddler tried to run her off, she turned his cart over and sent his oysters skittering across the cobbles. Customs officers from the Chike port would buy from her, and paddlers from the drowned town, whose sunken domes and towers poked up from the green waters of the lagoon. One time when Bray took to her bed with her moon blood, Cat had pushed her barrow to the Purple Harbour to sell crabs and prawns to oarsmen off the Sea Lord's pleasure barge, covered stem to stern with laughing faces. Other days she followed the Sweetwater River to the Moon Pool. She sold to swaggering bravos in striped satin, and to keyholders and justiciers in drab coats of brown and grey. But she always returned to the Ragman's Harbour.
"Oysters, clams, and cockles," the girl shouted as she pushed her barrow along the wharfs. "Mussels, prawns, and cockles!"
A dirty orange cat came padding after her, drawn by the sound of her call. Farther on, a second cat appeared, a sad, bedraggled grey thing with a stubbed tail. Cats liked the smell of cat. Some days she would have a dozen trailing after her before the sun went down. From time to time the girl would throw an oyster at them and watch to see who came away with it. The biggest toms would seldom win, she noticed. Oft or not, the prize went to some smaller, quicker animal, thin and mean and hungry.
"Like me," she told herself. Her favourite was a scrawny old tom with a chewed ear who reminded her of a cat she'd once chased all around the Red Keep. "No, that was some other girl, not me."
Two of the ships that had been here yesterday were gone, Cat saw, but five new ones had docked. a small carrack called the Brazen Monkey, a huge Ebenezer whaler that reeked of tar and blood and whale oil, two battered cogs from Pentos, and a lean green galley up from old Valentus. Cat stopped at the foot of every gangplank to cry her clams and oysters, once in the trade talk and once in the common tongue of Westeros. A crewman on the whaler cursed at her so loudly that he scared away her cats, and one of the Pentoshi oarsmen asked how much she wanted for the clam between her legs, but she fared better at the other ships. A mate on the green galley wharfed half a dozen oysters and told him how his captain had been killed by the Lycene pirates, who had tried to board them near the stepstones.
"That bastard Sarn, it was, with old mother's son, and his big Valyrian. We got away, but just."
The little Brazen Monkey proved to be from Gulltown, with a Westerosi crew who were glad to talk to someone in the common tongue. One asked how a girl from King's Landing came to be selling mussels on the docks of Braavos, so she had to tell her tale.
"We're here 4 days, and 4 long nights," another told her. "Where's a man to go to find a bit of sport?"
"The mummers at the ship are doing 7 drunken oarsmen, Cat told them. "And there's eel fights in the Spotted Cellar down by the gates of Drowntown. Or if you want, you can go by the Moon Pool, where the Braavos duel at night."
"Aye, that's good," another sailor said. "But what was really wanting was a woman."
"The best whores are at the Happy Port, down by where the mummer's ship is moored." She pointed.
Some of the dockside whores were vicious, and sailors fresh from the sea never knew which ones. Saroni was the worst. Everyone said she had robbed and killed 12 men, rolling the bodies into the canals to feed the eels. The drunken daughter could be sweet, when sober, but not with wine in her. And Canker Jane was really a man.
"Ask for Mary. Marilyn is her true name, but everyone calls her Mary. And she is."
Mary bought 12 oysters every time Cat came by the brothel, and shared them with her girls. She had a good heart, everyone agreed.
"That and the biggest pair of teats in all of Braavos."
Mary herself was fond of boasting. Her girls were nice as well. Blushing Bethany and the sailor's wife. One-eyed Ina, who could tell your fortune from a drop of blood. Pretty little Lana. Even Asadora, the Ebenezer woman with a moustache. They might not be beautiful, but they were kind to her.
"The Happy Port is where all the porters go," Cat assured the men of the Brazen Monkey.
"The boys unload the ships," Mary says, "and my girls unload the lads who sail them."
"What about them fancy whores the singers sing about?"
asked the youngest monkey, a red-haired boy with freckles who could not have been much more than 6 and 10.
"Are they as pretty as they say? Where would I get one of them?"
His shipmates looked at him and laughed.
"7 ills, boy," said one of them. "Might be the captain could get himself a courtesan, but only if he sold the bloody ship. That sort of cunt's for lords and such, not for the likes of us."
The courtesans of Braavos were famed across the world. Singers sang of them, goldsmiths and jewelers showered them with gifts, craftsmen begged for the honour of their custom, merchant princes paid royal ransoms to have them on their arms at balls and feasts and mummer shows, and Braavos slew each other in their names. As she pushed her barrow along the canals, Cat would sometimes glimpse one of them, floating by, on her way to an evening with some lover. Every courtesan had her own barge, and servants to pole her to her trysts. The poetess always had a book to hand. The moon shadow wore only white and silver, and the Merlin Queen was never seen without her mermaids, 4 young maidens in the blush of their first flowering, who held her train and did her hair. Each courtesan was more beautiful than the last. Even the Veil Lady was beautiful, though only those she took as lovers ever saw her face.
"I sold 3 cockles to a courtesan," Cat told the sailors. "She called to me as she was stepping off her barge.
Brusco had made it plain to her that she was never to speak to a courtesan unless she was spoken to first. But the woman had smiled at her and paid her in silver, 10 times what the cockles had been worth.
Which one was this now? The Queen of Cockles, was it?
The Black Pearl, she told them.
Mary claimed the Black Pearl was the most famous courtesan of all.
She's descended from the dragons, that one, the woman had told Cat. The first Black Pearl was a pirate queen. A Westerosi prince took her for a lover and got a daughter on her, who grew up to be a courtesan. Her own daughter followed her, and her daughter after her, until you get to this one.
What'd she say to you, Cat?
She said, I'll take 3 cockles, and you have some hot sauce, little one,
the girl had answered.
And what did you say?
I said, no, my lady, and don't call me little one. My name is Cat. I should have hot sauce, Becco does, and he sells 3 times as many oysters as Brusco.
Cat told the kindly man about the Black Pearl, too.
Her true name is Belgair Utheries, she informed him.
It was one of the 3 things that she had learned.
It is, the priest said softly. Her mother was Belinara, but the first Black Pearl was a Belgair as well.
Cat knew that the men of the Brazen Monkey would not care about the name of a courtesan's mother, though. Instead, she asked them for tidings of the 7 kingdoms and the war.
War?
Laughed one of them.
What war? There's no war.
Not in Gold Town, said another. Not in the Vale. The little lord's kept us out of it, same as his mother did.
Same as his mother did.
The Lady of the Vale was her own mother's sister.
Lady Lyser, she said. Is she
dead?
Finished the freckled boy, whose head was full of courtesans.
Aye, murdered by her own singer.
Oh,
it's not to me. A Cat of the Canals never had an aunt. She never did.
Cat lifted her barrow and wheeled away from the Brazen Monkey, bumping over cobblestones.
Oysters, clams, and cockles, she called. Oysters, clams, and cockles.
She sold most of her clams to the porters, offloading the big wine cog from the arbour, and the rest to the men repairing a mirish trading galley that had been savaged by the storms. Farther down the dock she came on Taganaro, sitting with his back against a piling, next to Casso, king of seals. He bought some mussels from her, and Casso barked and let her shake his flipper.
"You come work with me, Cat,"
urged Taganaro, as he was sucking mussels from their shells. He had been looking for a new partner ever since the drunken daughter put her knife through little Narbo's hand.
"I give you more than Brusco, and you would not smell like fish."
"Casso likes the way I smell," she said.
The king of seals barked as if to agree.
"Is Narbo's hand no better?"
3 fingers do not bend, complained Taganaro between mussels.
"What good is a cut purse who cannot use his fingers? Narbo was good at picking pockets, not so good at picking oars."
"And Mary says the same."
Cat was sad. She liked little Narbo, even if he was a thief.
"What will he do?"
"Pull an oar," he says. 2 fingers are enough for that, he thinks. And the sea lord's always looking for more oarsmen. I tell him, Narbo, no. That sea is colder than a maiden, and crueler than a whore. Better you should cut off the end and beg.
Casso knows I'm right, don't you, Casso? The seal barked, and Cat had to smile. She tossed another cockle his way before she went off on her own. The day was nearly done by the time Cat reached the happy port, across the alley from where the ship was anchored. Some of the mummers sat up atop the listing hull, passing a skin of wine from hand to hand. But when they saw Cat's barrow, they came down for some oysters. She asked them how it went with 7 drunken oarsmen. Joss the Gloom shook his head.
Quench finally came on Alaco abed with Slowey. They went at one another with mummers' swords, and both of them have left us. We'll only be 5 drunken oarsmen tonight, it would seem.
We shall strive to make up in drunkenness what we lack in oarsmen, declared Mermello. I, for one, am equal to the task.
Little Narbo wants to be an oarsman, Cat told them. If you got him,
You'd have six.
You'd best go to see Mary, just told her. You know how sour she gets without her oysters.
When Cat slipped inside the brothel, though, she found Mary sitting in the common room with her eyes shut, listening to Darian play his wood harp. Ina was there, too, braiding Lana's fine, long, golden hair.
Another stupid love song.
Lana was always begging the singer to play her stupid love songs. She was the youngest of the whores. Only 10 and 4. Mary asked 3 times as much for her as for any of the other girls, Cat knew. It made her angry to see Darian sitting there so brazen, making eyes at Lana, as his fingers danced across the harp strings. The whores called him the Black Singer, but there was hardly any black about him now. With a coin his singing brought him, the crow had transformed himself into a peacock. Today he wore a plush purple cloak lined with vair, a striped white and lilac tunic, and the partly coloured breeches of a bravo. But he owned a silken cloak as well, and one made of burgundy velvet that was lined with cloth of gold. The only black about him was his boots. Cat had heard him tell Lana that he'd thrown all the rest in a canal. "I'm done with darkness," he had announced. "Here's a man of the night's watch," she thought, as he sang about some stupid lady throwing herself off some stupid tower because her stupid prince was dead. "The lady should go kill the ones who killed her prince, and the singer should be on the wall." When Darian had first appeared at the Happy Port, Arya had almost asked if he would take her with him back to Eastwatch, until she heard him telling Bethany that he was never going back. "Hard beds, salt cod, and endless watches, that's the wall," he said. "Besides, there's no one half as pretty as you at Eastwatch. How could I ever leave you?" He had said the same thing to Lana, Cat had heard, and to one of the whores at the cattery, and even to the nightingale the night he played at the House of Seven Lamps.
"I wish I'd been here the night the fat one hit him."
Mary's whores still laughed about that. Ina said the fat boy had gone red as beet every time she touched him. But when he started trouble, Mary had him dragged outside and thrown in the canal. Cat was thinking about the fat boy, remembering how she had saved him from Tero and Orbello, when the sailor's wife appeared beside her.
"Oh, he sings a pretty song,"
she murmured softly in the common tongue of Westeros.
"The gods must have loved him to give him such a voice, and that fair face as well." "He is fair of face and foul of heart," thought Arya,
but she did not say it. Darian had once wed the sailor's wife, who would only bed with men who married her. The Happy Port sometimes had 3 or 4 weddings a night. Often the cheerful, wine-soaked red priest, Ezzelino, performed the rites. Elsewise it was Eustace, who had once been a septon at the Sept Beyond the Sea. If neither priest nor septon was on hand, one of the whores would run to the ship and fetch back a mummer. Mary always claimed the mummers made much better priests than priests, especially Mamello. The weddings were loud and jolly, with a lot of drinking. Whenever Cat happened by with her barrow, the sailor's wife would insist that her new husband buy some oysters to stiffen him for the consummation. She was good that way, and quick to laugh as well. But Cat thought there was something sad about her, too. The other whores said that the sailor's wife visited the Isle of the Gods on the days when her flower was in bloom, and knew all the gods who lived there, even the ones that Braavos had forgotten. They said she went to pray for her first husband, her true husband, who had been lost at sea when she was a girl no older than Lana.
"She thinks that if she finds the right god, maybe he will send the winds and blow her old love back to her,"
said one-eyed Ina, who had known her longest.
"But I pray it never happens. Her love is dead. I could taste that in her blood. If he ever should come back to her, it will be a corpse."
Darian's song was finally ending. As the last notes faded in the air, Lana gave a sigh, and the singer put his harp aside and pulled her up into his lap. He had just started to tickle her when Cat said loudly,
"There's oysters
if anyone is wanting some.
And Mary's eyes popped open.
Good, said the woman. Bring them in, child. Ina, fetch some bread and vinegar.
The swollen red sun hung in the sky behind the row of masts when Cat took her leave of the happy port, with a plump purse of coins and a barrow empty but for salt and seaweed. Darien was leaving, too. He had promised to sing at the Inn of the Green Eel this evening, he told her, as they strolled along together.
Every time I play the eel, I come away with silver, he boasted. And some nights there are captains there, and owners.
They crossed a little bridge and made their way down a crooked back street as the shadows of the day grew longer.
Soon I will be playing in the Purple, and after that the Sea Lord's Palace,
Darien went on. Cat's empty barrow clattered over the cobblestones, making its own sort of rattling music.
Yesterday I ate herring with a horse, but within the year I'll be having emperor crab with courtesans.
What happened to your brother?
Cat asked. The fat one. Did he ever find a ship to Old Town? He said he was supposed to sail on the Lady Euchenora.
We all were. Lord Snow's command. I told Sam, leave the old man, but the fat fool would not listen.
The last light of the setting sun shone in his hair.
Well, it's too late now.
Just so, said Cat, as they stepped into the gloom of a twisty little alley. By the time Cat returned to Brusco's house, an evening fog was gathering above the small canal. She put away her barrow, found Brusco in his counting room, and thumped her purse down on the table in front of him. She thumped the boots down, too. Brusco gave the purse a pat.
Good, but what's this?
Boots.
Good boots are hard to find, said Brusco, but these are too small for my feet.
He picked one up to squint at it.
The moon will be black tonight,
she reminded him.
Best you pray, then.
Brusco shoved the boots aside and poured out the coins to count them.
Valor de Heres.
Valor Margolis, she thought.
Fog rose all around as she walked through the streets of Braavos. She was shivering a little by the time she pushed through the weirwood door into the house of black and white. Only a few candles burned this evening, flickering like fallen stars. In the darkness all the guards were strangers. Down in the vaults, she untied Cat's threadbare cloak, pulled Cat's fishy brown tunic over her head, kicked off Cat's salt-stained boots, climbed out of Cat's small clothes, and bathed in lemon water to wash away the very smell of Cat of the Canals. When she emerged, soaped and scrubbed pink, with her brown hair plastered to her cheeks, Cat was gone. She donned clean robes and a pair of soft cloth slippers, and padded to the kitchens to beg some food of Uma. The priests and acolytes had already eaten, but the cook had saved a piece of nice fried cod for her, and some mashed yellow turnips. She wolfed it down, washed the dish, then went to help the waif prepare her potions. Her part was mostly fetching, scrambling up ladders to find the herbs and leaves the waif required.
Sweet sleep is the gentlest of poisons, the waif told her as she was grinding some with a mortar and pestle. A few grains will slow a pounding heart and stop a hand from shaking and make a man feel calm and strong. A pinch will grant a night of deep and dreamless sleep. 3 pinches will produce that sleep that does not end. The taste is very sweet, so it's best used in cakes and pies and honeyed wines. Here, you can smell the sweetness.
She let her have a whiff, then sent her up the ladder to find a red glass bottle.
This is a crueler poison, but tasteless and odorless, hence easier to hide. The tears of lice, men call it, dissolved in wine or water, it eats at a man's bowels and belly, and kills as a sickness of those parts. Smell.
Arya sniffed and smelled nothing. The waif put the tears to one side and opened a fat stone jar.
This paste is spiced with basilisk blood. It will give cooked flesh a savoury smell, but if eaten it produces violent madness in beasts as well as men. A mouse will attack a lion after a taste of basilisk blood.
Arya chewed her lip.
Would it work on dogs?
On any animal with warm blood? The waif slapped her. She raised a hand to her cheek, more surprised than hurt.
Why did you do that?
It is Arya of House Stark who chews on her lip whenever she is thinking. Are you Arya of House Stark?
I am no one.
She was angry. Who are you? She did not expect the waif to answer, but she did. I was born the only child of an ancient house, my noble father's heir, the waif replied. My mother died when I was little. I have no memory of her.
When I was six, my father wed again. His new wife treated me kindly until she gave birth to a daughter of her own. Then it was her wish that I should die.
So her own blood might inherit my father's wealth. She should have sought the favor of the many-faced god, but she could not bear the sacrifice he would ask of her. Instead, she thought to poison me herself. It left me as you see me now. But I did not die. When the healers of the House of the Red Hands told my father what she had done, he came here and made sacrifice, offering up all his wealth and me. Him of many faces heard his prayer. I was brought to the temple to serve, and my father's wife received the gift. Arya considered her warily.
Is that true?
There is truth in it, and lies as well. There is an untruth and an exaggeration. She had been watching the waif's face the whole time she had told her story, but the other girl had shown her no signs.
The many-faced god took 2/3 of your father's wealth, not all.
Just so. That was my exaggeration. Arya grinned, realized she was grinning, and gave her cheek a pinch.
Truly a face, she told herself. My smile is my servant. He should come at my command.
What part was the lie?
No part.
I lied about the lie.
Did you? Are you lying now?
But before the waif could answer, the kindly man stepped into the chamber, smiling.
You have returned to us. The moon is black.
It is.
What 3 new things do you know that you did not know when last you left us?
I know 30 new things, she almost said.
3 of little Narbo's fingers will not bend. He means to be an oarsman.
It is good to know this.
And what else?
She thought back on her day.
Quince and Alaco had a fight and left the ship, but I think they'll come back.
Do you only think, or do you know?
I only think,
she had to confess, even though she was certain of it. Mamas had to eat the same as other men, and Quince and Alaco were not good enough for the Blue Lantern.
Just so, said the kindly man. And the 3rd thing?
This time she did not hesitate.
Darian is dead, the black singer who was sleeping at the Happy Port. He was really a deserter from the Night's Watch. Someone slit his throat and pushed him into a canal, but they kept his boots.
Well, good boots are hard to find.
Just so.
She tried to keep her face still.
Who could have done this thing, I wonder? Arya of House Stark.
She watched his eyes, his mouth, the muscles of his jaw.
Oh, that girl. I thought she had left Braavos. Who are you?
No one. You lie. He turned to the waif.
My throat is dry. Do me a kindness and bring a cup of wine for me and warm milk for our friend Arya, who has returned to us so unexpectedly.
On her way across the city, Arya had wondered what the kindly man would say when she told him about Darian. Maybe he would be angry with her, or maybe he would be pleased that she had given the singer the gift of the many-faced god. She had played this talk out in her head 50 times, like a mummer in a show. But she had never thought warm milk. When the milk came, Arya drank it down. It smelled a little burnt and had a bitter aftertaste.
"Go to bed now, child," the kindly man said. "On the morrow you must serve."
That night she dreamed she was a wolf again,
but it was different from the other dreams. In this dream she had no pack. She prowled alone, bounding over rooftops and padding silently beside the banks of a canal, stalking shadows through the fog. When she woke the next morning, she was blind. Samwell. The Cinnamon Wind was a swan ship out of Tall Trees Town on the Summer Isles, where men were black, women were wanton, and even the guards were strange. She had no septon aboard her to lead them in the prayers of passing, so the task fell to Samwell Tarley, somewhere off the sun-scorched southern coast of Dawn. Sam donned his blacks to say the words, though the afternoon was warm and muggy, with nary a breath of wind. "He was a good man," he began, but as soon as he had said the words, he knew that they were wrong. "No, he was a great man, a maester of the citadel, chained and sworn, and sworn brother of the night's watch, ever faithful. When he was born, they named him for a hero who had died too young. But though he lived a long, long time, his own life was no less heroic. No man was wiser, or gentler, or kinder. At the wall, a dozen lords commander came and went during his years of service, but he was always there to counsel them. He counseled kings as well. He could have been a king himself, but when they offered him the crown, he told them they should give it to his younger brother. How many men would do that? Sam felt the tears welling in his eyes and knew he could not go on much longer. He was the blood of the dragon, and now his fire has gone out. He was Aemon Targaryen, and now his watch is ended. And now his watch is ended, Jilly murmured after him, rocking the babe in her arms. Kojamo echoed her in the common tongue of Westeros, then repeated the words in the summer tongue for Zondo and her father and the rest of the assembled crew. Sam hung his head and began to weep, his sob so loud and wrenching that they made his whole body shake. Jilly came and stood beside him and let him cry upon her shoulder. There were tears in her eyes as well. The air was moist and warm and dead calm, and the Cinnamon Wind was adrift upon a deep blue sea far beyond the sight of land.
"Black Sam said good words," Zondo said. "Now we drink his life."
He shouted something in the summer tongue, and a cask of spice rum was rolled up onto the after-deck and breached, so those on watch might down a cup in the memory of the old blind dragon. The crew had known him only a short while, but Summer Islanders revered the elderly and celebrated their dead. Sam had never drunk rum before. The liquor was strange and heady, sweet at first, but with a fiery aftertaste that burned his tongue. He was tired, so tired. Every muscle he had was aching, and there were other aches in places where Sam hadn't known he had muscles. His knees were stiff, his hands covered with fresh new blisters, and raw, sticky patches of skin where the old blisters had burst. Yet between them, rum and sadness seemed to wash his hurts away.
"If only we could have gotten him to Old Town. The Archmaesters might have saved him," he told Jilly, as they sipped their rum on the Cinnamon Wind's high forecastle. "The healers of the citadel are the best in the Seven Kingdoms. For a while I thought, I hoped."
On Braavos it had seemed possible that Aemon might recover. Zondo's talk of dragons had almost seemed to restore the old man to himself. That night he ate every bite Sam put before him.
"No one ever looked for a girl," he said. "It was a prince that was promised, not a princess. Rhaegar, I thought the smoke was from the fire that devoured Summerhall on the day of his birth, the salt from the tears shed for those who died. He shared my belief, when he was young. But later he became persuaded that it was his own son who fulfilled the prophecy, for a comet had been seen above King's Landing on the night Aegon was conceived, and Rhaegar was certain the bleeding star had to be a comet. What fools we were! We thought ourselves so wise. The error crept in from the translation. Dragons are neither male nor female. Barth saw the truth of that. But now one and now the other is changeable as flame. The language misled us all for 1,000 years. Daenerys is the one, born amidst salt and smoke. The dragons prove it.
Just talking of her seemed to make him stronger.
I must go to her. I must. Would that I was even 10 years younger.
The old man had been so determined that he had even walked up the plank onto the cinnamon wind on his own two legs, after Sam had made arrangements for their passage. He had already given his sword and scabbard to Zondo to repay the big mate for the feather cloak he'd ruined saving Sam from drowning. The only things of value that still remained to them were the books they had brought from the vaults of Castle Black. Sam parted with them glumly.
"They were meant for the Citadel," he said, when Zondo asked him what was wrong.
When the mate translated those words, the captain laughed.
"Kahuramau says the grey men will be having these books still,"
Zondo told him.
"Only they will be buying them from Kahuramau. The masters give good silver for books they are not having. And sometimes red and yellow gold."
The captain wanted Aemon's chain as well, but there Sam had refused. It was a great shame for any maester to surrender his chain, he had explained. Zondo had to go over that part 3 times before Kahuramau accepted it. By the time the dealing was done, Sam was down to his boots and blacks and small clothes, and the broken horn Jon Snow had found on the fist of First Men.
"I had no choice," he told himself. "We could not stay in Braavos, and short of theft or beggary, there was no other way to pay for passage."
He would have counted it cheap at thrice the price, if only they had gotten Maester Aemon safe to Old Town. Their passage south had been a stormy one, however, and every gale took its toll on the old man's strength and spirits. At Pentos, he asked to be brought up onto deck so Sam might paint a picture of the city for him with words. But that was the last time he left the captain's bed. Soon after that, his wits began to wander once again. By the time the cinnamon wind swept past the bleeding tower into Tyrish Harbour, Aemon no longer spoke of trying to find a ship to take him east. Instead, his talk turned back to Old Town and the archmaesters of the citadel.
"You must tell them, Sam," he said. "The archmaesters, you must make them understand. The men who were at the citadel when I was have been dead for 50 years. These others never knew me. My letters in Old Town, they must have read like the ravings of an old man whose wits had fled. You must convince them where I could not. Tell them, Sam. Tell them how it is upon the wall, the whites and the white walkers, the creeping cold."
"I will," Sam promised. "I will add my voice to yours, maester. We will both tell them, the two of us together."
"No," the old man said. "It must be you. Tell them the prophecy, my brother's dream. Lady Melisandre has misread the signs. Stannis has some of the dragon blood in him, yes. His brothers did as well. Rael, Egg's little girl, she was how they came by it. Their father's mother. She used to call me Uncle Maester when she was a little girl. I remembered that. So I allowed myself to hope. Perhaps I wanted to... We all deceive ourselves when we want to believe. Melisandre
most of all, I think. The sword is wrong. She has to know that. Light without heat, an empty glamour. The sword is wrong, and the false light can only lead us deeper into darkness, Sam. Daenerys is our hope. Tell them that, at the Citadel. Make them listen. They must send her a maester. Daenerys must be counseled, taught, protected. For all these years I've lingered, waiting and watching, and now that the day has dawned, I am too old. I'm dying, Sam.
Tears ran from his blind, white eyes at that admission.
Death should hold no fear for a man as old as me. But it does. Isn't that silly? It's always dark where I am, so why should I fear the darkness? Yet I cannot help but wonder what will follow when the last warmth leaves my body. Will I feast forever in the Father's golden hall, as the Septon say? Will I talk with Egg again, find Darien whole and happy, hear my sisters singing to their children? What if the horse lords have the truth in it? Will I ride the night sky forever on a stallion made of flame? Or must I return again to this vale of sorrow? Who can say, truly, who has been beyond the wall of death to see? Only the whites, and we know what they are like. We know.
There was little and less that Sam could say to that, but he had given the old man what little comfort he could. And Jilly came in afterward and sang a song for him, a nonsense song thing that she'd learned from some of Craster's other wives. It made the old man smile and helped him go to sleep. That had been one of his last good days. After that, the old man spent more time sleeping than awake, curled up beneath a pile of furs in the captain's cabin. Sometimes he would mutter in his sleep. When he woke, he'd call for Sam, insisting that he had to tell him something. But oft as not, he would have forgotten what he meant to say by the time that Sam arrived. Even when he did recall, his talk was all a jumble. He spoke of dreams and never named the dreamer, of a glass candle that could not be lit and eggs that would not hatch. He said the Sphinx was the riddle, not the Riddler, whatever that meant. He asked Sam to read for him from a book by Septon Barth, whose writings had been burned during the reign of Baelor the Blessed. Once he woke up, weeping.
"The dragon must have three heads," he wailed. "But I am too old and frail to be one of them. I should be with her, showing her the way, but my body has betrayed me."
As the cinnamon wind made her way through the stepstones, Maester Aemon forgot Sam's name, oft as not. Some days he took him for one of his dead brothers. He was too frail for such a long voyage, Sam told Jilly on the forecastle, after another sip of the rum. John should have seen that. Aemon was 102 years old. He should never have been sent to sea. If he'd stayed at Castle Black, he might have lived another 10 years. Or else she might have burned him, the Red Woman. Even here, 1,000 leagues from the wall, Jilly was reluctant to say Lady Melisandre's name aloud. She wanted King's blood for her fires. Val knew she did. Lord Snow, too. That was why they made me take Dala's babe away and leave my own behind in his place. Maester Aemon went to sleep and didn't wake up. But if he had stayed, she would have burned him. He will still burn, Sam thought miserably. Only now I have to do it. The Targaryens always gave their fallen to the flames. K'huru Mo' would not allow a funeral pyre aboard the Cinnamon Wind. So Aemon's corpse had been stuffed inside a cask of Black Belly rum to preserve it until the ship reached Oldtown.
The night before he died, he asked if he might hold the babe,
Jilly went on.
I was afraid he might drop him, but he never did. He rocked him and hummed a song to him, and Dala's boy reached up and touched his face. The way he pulled his lip, I thought he might be hurting him. But it only made the old man laugh.
She stroked Sam's hand.
We could name the little one Maester, if you like, when he's old enough. Not now. We could.
Maester is not a name. You could call him Eamon, though. Jilly thought about that.
Dala brought him forth during battle, as the sword sang all around her. That should be his name. Eamon Battleborn. Eamon Steelsong.
A name even my lord father might like. A warrior's name. The boy was Mansraider's son, and Craister's grandson, after all. He had none of Sam's craven blood.
Yes, call him that. When he is two, she promised, not before. Where is the boy?
Sam thought to ask. Between rum and sorrow, it had taken him that long to realize that Jilly did not have the babe with her.
Kojo has him. I asked her to take him for a while.
Oh! Kojo Mo was the captain's daughter, taller than Sam, and slender as a spear, with skin as black and smooth as polished jet. She captained the ship's red archers, too, and pulled a double-curved golden heart bow that could send a shaft 400 yards. When the pirates had attacked them in the Stepstones, Kojo's arrows had slain a dozen of them, while Sam's own shafts were falling in the water. The only thing Kojo Mo loved better than her bow was bouncing Dala's boy upon her knee and singing to him in the summer tongue. The wildling prince had become the darling of all the women in the crew, and Jilly seemed to trust them with him, as she had never trusted any man.
"That was kind of Kojo," Sam said. "I was afraid of her at first," said Jilly. "She was so black, and her teeth were so big and white. I was afraid she was a beastling or a monster, but she's not. She's good. I like her."
"I know you do." For most of her life, the only man Jilly had known had been the terrifying Craister. The rest of her world had been female.
"Men frighten her, but women don't,"
Sam realized. He could understand that. Back at Horn Hill, he had preferred the company of girls as well. His sisters had been kind to him, and though the other girls would sometimes taunt him, cruel words were easier to shrug off than the blows and buffets he got from the other castle boys. Even now, on the Cinnamon Wind, Sam felt more comfortable with Kojo Mo than with her father, though that might be because she spoke the common tongue and he did not.
"I like you too, Sam," whispered Jilly, "and I like this drink. It tastes like fire."
"Yes," Sam thought, "a drink for dragons." Their cups were empty, so he went over to the cask and filled them once again. The sun was low in the west, he saw. Swollen to thrice its proper size, its ruddy light made Jilly's face seem flushed and red. They drank a cup to Kojo Mo, and one to Dala's boy, and one to Jilly's babe back on the wall, and after that nothing would do but to drink two cups for Eamon of House Targaryen.
"May the father judge him justly," Sam said, sniffing.
The sun was almost gone by the time they were done with Maester Eamon. Only a long, thin line of red still glowed upon the western horizon, like a slash across the sky. Jilly said that the drink was making the ship spin round, so Sam helped her down the ladder to the women's quarters in the bow of the ship. There was a lantern hanging just inside the cabin, and he managed to bang his head on it going in.
"Ow!"
he said, and Jilly said,
"Are you hurt? Let me see."
She leaned close and kissed his mouth. Sam found himself kissing her back.
"I said the words," he thought, but her hands were tugging at his blacks, pulling at the laces of his breeches.
He broke off the kiss long enough to say,
"We can't." But Jilly said, "We can," and covered his mouth with her own again.
The Cinnamon Wind was spinning all around them, and he could taste the rum on Jilly's tongue, and the next thing her breasts were bare, and he was touching them.
"I said the words," Sam thought again,
but one of her nipples found its way between his lips. It was pink and hard, and when he sucked on it, the milk filled his mouth, mingled with a taste of rum, and he had never tasted anything so fine and sweet and good.
"If I do this, I'm no better than..."